Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben. Today, I'm delighted to say my guest is Mark Dooley, the Irish philosopher, writer, and journalist. And we're talking to Mark today about his new book, Roger Scruton, The Philosopher in Dover Beach, an intellectual biography, just out in paperback. The hardback came out, I think, about 2009. This is an expanded edition. It's got some new material in it, and it's in paperback, much more accessible. And we're really excited to talk to Mark about this book. So, Mark, thank you for coming on to the show today.
The delight of the big birds.
Well, listen, before we talk about the book, Mark, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? You're obviously a philosopher. You've done a great deal of writing, published a good number of books on your own merits. Some of the earlier works going back to your initial interest in continental philosophy. And I suppose you've come a long way from then, I should say, in some respects, to this extensive engagement with Scruton that's marked your career, I suppose, over the last 20 years or thereabouts.
Yes, one finds oneself at the beginning of one's career as a young academic, a young visionary, as it were, seeing the world as the great masters of suspicion see the world, you know, that everything needs to change and we need, you know, fervor and revolution and all of that sort of stuff. And although I was never swept along by that tide of, you know, revolutionary exuberance, I was, to a certain degree, tempered by my religious instincts. But nonetheless, I did see need for change. And until, of course, reality bit. And I saw that the wind of change really blows so far without disturbing the ordinary routines of ordinary people, which are in many ways sacred and the bedrock of society. So that turned me from my initial enthusiasm for, I suppose it's liberalism with a small L, towards conservatism read conservationism. You know, conserving things because of the merit that, you know, they embody. Those things linking us to the past, to absent generations, and finding wisdom in those things to go forward. So it's not merely glancing to the past continually. It's looking to the past for guidance for where we go from here. And of course, that was always the way our forebears did it. I found in Roger Scruton someone who was otherworldly in his own way, but who nonetheless had his finger on the pulse of the age and knew exactly what we needed to march forward amidst the kind of Marxist menace, as he saw it, that was sweeping across the globe in culture, in the arts, in religion, in all the great activities of human life. So it was became a calling, I think, of mine to represent him, to open him to a wider audience, to break apart the caricature, the appalling caricature that was painted of him in the press and elsewhere, and to reveal the true nature of what this man, who I consider to have been one of the great geniuses of the 20th and 21st centuries.
It's quite striking, Mark, that you say that, because you knew and worked closely with Jack Derrida as well at the start of your career as well, didn't you?
I did. He was a great friend, and I was once sitting in Roger Scruton's kitchen, and the great Oxford analytic philosopher David Wiggins was there with us, and he couldn't understand this. He said, "How can you both write books on Derrida and Scruton?" And I said, "Well, they are both. I don't want to get too technical here, but I'll just put it like this: they are both sons of the great philosopher Hegel, the great 19th century philosopher Hegel, who was a great philosopher of home and memory." I said, "One of them was a prodigal son, that was Derrida. The other was a faithful son." the faithful son who stays at home and looks after the fields while the other one goes off and does his business elsewhere. I said, one talks about memory that cannot be retrieved. You know, the loss of identity that we've got kind of dumped in ourselves, and that's what we're ever nomadic, ever cut from our origins, ever cut from our source, our sacred source, and so on. That's Derrida. The other looks to what can be retrieved and ought to be retrieved in memory. Okay, so whereas Derrida talks about what he called the catastrophe of memory, Roger Scruton talks about, well, you know, in the words of John Ruskin, the lamp of memory, and how that lamp shines a light on all our endeavors, and also, I said at the beginning of the interview, to guide our path forward. So really, it's just having two people coming out of the same intellectual heritage, but looking at things, looking at the same themes from very different perspectives. But I don't see any inconsistencies in any of my writings, really. I think that they're all coming out of this great, the great orbit that Hegel set out for us, and just dealing with the ramifications of his thought in different ways.
Now, Mark, it's fascinating you present the relationship between those two thinkers, Derrida and Scruton, as the two characters, the two sons in the prodigal son parable. And we might come back to the unhappiness of the elder son at home and his not quite sureness if he really fits in when we come to think about Scruton's relationship with religion and with organized Christianity in particular. But before we come to all of that, who was Roger Scruton? Your subtitle here is an intellectual biography. The book is that, but it's more than that as well, isn't it? So just give us in summary form the key moments really of Scruton's own life, which in some ways parallels your own movements in terms of a conserving philosophical direction.
We did a book a number of years ago called Conversations with Roger Scruton, where I went and I sat down with him in his lovely idyllic Wiltshire farm for 3 days, and we went through his life systematically. And of course, for me, it was quite easy to see that the development of his life ran in tandem with the development of his thought. You know, this was no armchair philosopher. And one of the reasons, by the way, that I was taken with Derrida too was because he was no armchair philosopher. Both of them, as it happens, this is a recorded little vignette in the Conversations with Roger Scruton book, where I say to him, do you know, when we first got onto the fact that Scruton and Derrida were both arrested by the secret police in Czechoslovakia in the communist era in the 1980s for going to lecture to the underground resistance movement, led by people like Václav Havel and so on. And all in ordinary, every person, chimney sweeps, priests, poets, politicians, all of them, would be reduced to, you know, the workers, as it were, of the Soviet system, and we're looking for hope. Now, both these men are part of the Jan Hus Association, who gave solace and comfort and direction and encouragement to those who were benighted by the communist system. Now, in the case of Derrida, he was a major international superstar. They planted drugs on him, arrested him, threw him into jail. And with Scruton, after one of the seminars, where he didn't go and preach revolutionary politics, he went and spoke about Aristotle and Kafka and so on, and they followed him. He records this on many occasions. All you hear is the footsteps on the deserted streets following him. He was beaten up, thrown down a stairwell, arrested, taken to prison. The following day, he was exiled, marched across the border with his briefcase at gunpoint and put on the index of undesirable people. I'd kid you not, index of undesirable people, and exiled for life. Of course, that wasn't to be the case. He was decorated at the highest levels in all of the post-communist countries up to his death. But then I said to Scruton, firstly acknowledged in conversations with Roger Scruton that Derrida, without Derrida having been arrested, you know, that their movement would never have got off the ground because Derrida was so powerful and intellectual. It took the intervention of François Mitterrand, the then French president, to get him out of jail, by the way, but they did get him out. And I said, well, do you know, I said, Roger, that he spent a couple of nights in jail just with a Romanian gypsy. And Roger turns to me and says, oh, wonderful. And that's what he felt personally about Derrida. He could learn more from the drunk Romanian gypsy than he could by going off to Mexico into the Black Sabbath Club album. However, these men were people who went and lived their thought, and Roger Scruton was always one of those. He started off in a modest socialist home with in High Wycombe, and his father, Jack Scruton, about whom he writes a lot, really resented his life, resented everything to do with his family, resented Roger, and made life very difficult for him. I think it was that kind of encouraged him to find solace in things that the father did not hold as valuable, such as culture, such as high culture, such as the arts. And through that, and his interest in that, self-taught in many ways, he found redemption from his loneliness. He didn't want to be an academic. He wanted to be some sort of cultural artiste. But he found himself in Cambridge. He started off with doing science and quickly turned to moral sciences, which of course is philosophy. Came under the direction of Elizabeth Anscombe, great English eccentric philosopher, Catholic philosopher, as a matter of fact, and got his thesis in aesthetics. So he combined his intellectual interest there with culture. But then, his fervor for the conservative way of life was already, swelling up on him. And he began to write art. The only one he ever did was write, as he said to me in conversations. What a screw. The only ever one he was write, become a writer. That is what I must do, he said. And he began to write every day. He set himself a target of 500 words every day, and he did so for the rest of his life. And he began to send stuff off to various periodicals and was noticed. Noticed so much that amongst the books that he was producing on architecture and culture and so on, he was snapped up by the Times in the 1980s and wrote a column for 4 years. Many of those I reproduced in a book I bought out in 2022 called Against the Tide, Best of Scruton's Columns, Commentaries, and Criticism. And he became a public figure, a figure of hate amongst the left, a figure of love amongst the right. Now, not the Thatcherite right, but those who really wanted to hold on to the world that they knew and not have it ravaged by left-wing ideology, especially as it was exported by the Soviet Union. He also, as I mentioned, went into the Soviet lands, visited all of them, gave great comfort and means of intellectual resistance to the movement, so much so, as I said to you, Crawford, earlier, that even in the week before he died, I was over there with him, and he was being decorated for the second time by Hungary. And I said, how are you going to make it to the embassy? Viktor Orban was coming to decorate him. He said, oh, well, I'll just have to get on with it. And he was wheeled in by his white Sophie and he received his medal and his decoration. And he spoke, as he always did, without notes, on the need for nations, so beautifully and so inspirationally. So the communist cause was always a highlight of his, and it was contiguous with his interest in culture, because the revival of the ancient cultures of Europe was the way that we would connect to our ancestral homeland and recover the home that had been ravaged by the communist system. And thus it was that he pursued a career whereby he left the academic world in the early 90s and lived out that life. He saw a home in anything that could root him back to home, such as farming, such as hunting, such as his writing on music, classical music, classical architecture, and speaking to people about these things as small groups, big groups, no matter where, across the world, giving them that sense that they too could reconfigure their homes, if not in fact in their imagination. And that gave comfort and solace to so many, and like it's greatly missed to this day. So what I'm trying to say to you basically is this, that this man lived as he wrote and thought, and the activities that he pursued were not through the avenue of the academy, which exiled him for the most part, but through living it out through farming, living it out through hunting, living it out through all those activities which bind and root us to absent generations.
Now, Mark, there's a lot in your book not surprising given your own interests personally, there's a lot in your book about religion. And you quote Scruton at one point describing himself as a voyeur of holiness, which is one of his remarkable turns of phrase. Did Scruton appreciate Christianity merely as offering a cohesive culture for a homeland? Or was he appreciating Christianity as something that made distinctive, maybe even exclusive, religious claims?
As I hinted on my book, there's an ambiguity in about this. On the one hand, he is a philosopher, and he's a philosopher who tries to come to religion, as Kant would put it, within the limits of reason alone. Coming up to the threshold, as he called another beautiful turn of phrase, and he was nothing if not a beautiful writer, to the threshold of the transcendental, and not being able to move to the other side, except on a certain occasion when you get intimations of infinity in our world, as he saw it through music, through wine, through the Eucharist, whatever it might be, all these moments of clarity when the world in itself, as he calls it, following Kant, opens up to us and we catch just what it means before it departs from us again, just like two people in love. When you reach beyond the flesh to the person that you desire, you can't grasp that person, but you attempt to hold and embrace and cling on to that person. But of course, the person is always ebbing and flowing, and all you're left with most of the time is the flesh. And you look into the eyes of the child, and even when that, you know, it's that thing that departs from the flesh when we die, that the spirit, as the Bible calls it, or this is more commonly known, the soul. But he saw that, as Hegel did, in every, you know, every part of our world has these apertures where the transcendental is revealed to us, but it's only so far that you can go. Now, Hegel thought you could go the full distance with it and get across to the other side. Scruton did not. And there's the great, you know, disconnect in his work between the Hegelian vision of a home, coming home to God, coming home to the world, coming home to oneself, coming home to one's history, coming home to the land, all Hegelian, all the way Scruton lived, as I said to you earlier. But when it came to actually crossing the threshold to God, that's where it started for him. You know, you couldn't do that, but you could again get intimations through the sacraments, intimations. And of course, Christians in the capital C don't believe that. They believe in the full presence of Christ, you know, as revealed to us through the incarnation and so forth and so on. Now, I saw Roger Scruton. I observed him in his church at Boca Chapel. Played the organ there. I saw him kneel to receive Holy Communion. He was not an atheist by any stretch of the imagination, as a lot of us cheerleaders like to maintain, which is absurd. I've written a lot about that, for all the reasons that I've outlined. But, you know, his whole point, his whole discourse is against science and pseudoscience and naturalism and Marxism, to show that when you put man in the place of God, you open up the world to an orgy of violence and decadence that can only be restrained by reinserting God on the throne that man has now occupied. So there is this tension. At one level, Scruton the man wants to embrace Christianity in all its theological beliefs and so on. Scruton the philosopher wants to come up to the threshold of those and yet hesitates. He's very much a Protestant in the, you know, that old sense. Very reserved when it comes to these things, whereas Hegel, who was a Protestant, likes to push right past and go full Catholic.
So in some ways, this goes back to your prodigal son metaphor that you started the conversation with, isn't it? That Scruton is in some ways occupying that elder son status. He's not quite sure, perhaps, how he fits into this home. So that's fascinating. Fascinating observation, Mark. Another of the really beautiful turns of phrases that you quote from Scruton in the book is his question about what happens to a culture that has survived its gods. And how does that shadow play out then in his thinking about what we might call post-Christian Western culture?
Roger believed that culture high culture offered the redemption to what he saw disparagingly as pop culture, that religion once offered but could no longer because of a loss of faith. And this is why the subtitle of the book is The Philosopher of Dover Beach, and Matthew Arnold's great poem where he talks about the ebb of faith and so on, and the dark, over the darkening flame. So it was very much a theme that ran right throughout Scruton's work. But culture could offer that redemption from loneliness and isolation that old religion used to offer, he believed. And it could do so by connecting us with ourselves, with our past, with our history, and shining a light on why narcissism, egoism, self-enclosed isolation, or self-imposed isolation, I should say, is mistaken and contrary to the fulfillment of our lives as human beings, our destinies as human beings. In so doing, he would employ Wagner, of whom he had great admiration. He wrote three books, actually, on Wagner, and all of which were profoundly beautiful, irrespective of what people think of Wagner. Roger cut past that and took him on his artistic merits alone. I happen to disagree with Scruton on this point. We disagreed about very little, but we did disagree about this, and it really came down again to the distinction. Always came down to the distinction between Kant and Hegel, and that it's this: that if you take culture, no matter how true everything he said about it was, and it does have that redeeming quality, and it does redeem you from isolation and loneliness, and allows you to see that you're part of a greater whole, a greater community. You're part of the great eternal society, as Edmund Burke called it. It does have that, those redeeming qualities. However, it can only take you so far. There will always be a lack in you. There will always be something with which you cannot identify, which goes beyond what Kant called the starry heavens above and the moral law within. And it will leave you kind of the fervor, the initial enthusiasm that you have, where that appetite is sated, will, like any form of natural desire, re-emerge when you'll feel the isolation, the loneliness kicking again, and you'll be the next hit by Mozart until that runs dry, and so forth and so on. So the blessings that are received through the sacramental way of life, where the full presence is revealed to you and enjoyed by you, and where you're not only reconciled to the community, and you're not only reconciled to the community of the living, the dead, and the unborn, as Burke called it, but you're reconciled to the sacramental community, really the great eternal society that Edmund Burke called it. And so, you're forever, as Hegel says, you'll forever hang in alienation. You'll let it just be suspended in alienation for as long as you take art or culture only as your pathway to redemption. And the full reconciliation that you require, that you desire from your fallenness, from your sinfulness, from your loneliness, can only be had by recognizing when every form of alienation is overcome, and when you stand before another human being in whom you recognize God. And that's the magnificence of the incarnation. That's why no other religion can offer that. You can see another self-consciousness stand before you saying, "I am He. I am in you, you are in me, we are one."
Mark, there's loads in this book that we just don't have time to talk about today. There's discussions of music, architecture, animals, the fascinating paradox that Scruton was suspicious of zoos but supportive of hunting. There's a huge amount in here that we just don't have time to unpack. So my final question takes us back to this theme of religion, which I know interests us both. Is it fair to think of Scruton as almost a Christian apologist?
Almost. I mean, there are many, 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 many religious people and spiritual people across our world who have derived great and enormous pleasure and solace from his work on religion. They all recognize that there is a hesitancy when it comes to the full-scale philosophy of religion or a post-scale theology. You won't find that. But what you will find is something of a great defense against those who would deny God, who would deny religion, the value of religion, who would deny the sacred, the great theme of his sacred of one's about all of his work, and who would deny that, as he said at one point, one of the great phrases that he has, you know, if you look at people as objects only, you will see that everything that Darwin said about them was correct. But if you look at them as subjects, you will see that the most important thing about them has no place in Darwin's theory. So subjectivity, the sacred, those two things that run throughout his whole corpus are the best that you can imagine a philosopher, a real, hugely intellectual man offering us in this day and age, who has by and large bypassed the old arguments for the existence of God and the old theological apologias, but who has come to this place where he can offer people intimations of the sacred and intimations of the infinite through a systematic philosophical framework that will nonetheless enrich their lives in a very practical way.
Well, Mark, it's been great to talk to you today, and we do appreciate you giving us your time. I know you're a busy man in the projects that you are pushing forward. We've been talking today about your book, Roger Scruton, The Philosopher in Dover Beach, an Intellectual Biography, just published in paperback by Bloomsbury, who, of course, published lots of Scruton's work as well. How can we keep in touch with your writing, and how can we find out what you might be working on at the moment?
DrMarkDooley.com. All one word, drmarkdooley.com. It's all there. And all the interviews, news about the books, and articles and so forth and so on.
And what could we look forward to reading next?
Well, there's a number of long pieces coming out on architecture and home, on a lot of commentary on the work that we just discussed. And a collection of writings assembled on various aspects of culture, religion, and politics, drawn from my work as a contributing editor to the European Conservative magazine.
Wonderful, Mark. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming onto the show to talk about this book, Roger Scruton, The Philosopher in Dover Beach, an Intellectual Biography, published in paperback by Bloomsbury just a few months ago. So thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on the New Books Network podcast.